It's Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Earlier today, I thought something a bit strange was afoot in the WPR studios. I saw coworkers shuffling slowly down the hall, arms outstretched with a vacant look in their eye. I ran for cover in a nearby office. Turns out it was just someone who didn't get enough sleep. And luckily, that's as close as we get to zombies here at WPR. But Halloween is in the air, and there are plenty of zombies to be found on movies and TV this time of year. Our next guest is going to help us dig into the zombie genre, something he says can tell us a lot about what society is scared of and why. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite zombie movie, TV show, or other media? What do you like about them? What do zombies signify to you? Why do you think they have such long-lasting power in pop culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Drago Mamsilovic is a senior lecturer in the Comparative Literature Program at UW-Milwaukee. He's currently teaching a class about zombies in the media. His latest article is called Monsters on MTV. Drago, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Drago, I understand that long before you started teaching about zombies, you were just a fan of the genre. Do you remember how you first came across them? What was your first zombie exposure?
My first zombie exposure was not a very positive one, unfortunately, because it happened when I was a young kid. I saw Michael Jackson's Thriller video for the very first time. And that was the day that I found out that zombies were absolutely terrifying. And, you know, to a young kid like me, they were also terrifyingly real, even though they are supernatural monsters, essentially. When I watched that video, even when I watch it today, I still get that same sense of the young kid watching and getting spooked by, you know, the spectacle of the dead body coming back to life and attacking the living and all of these things that, you know, I think really sort of embody both the best and the worst of zombie narratives.
And you really stuck with it. What in your mind makes the zombie unique and maybe a bit more interesting in the pantheon of horror movie villains?
Well, zombies, I think, have their own place in the pantheon because they sort of come back in waves. And, you know, if you track the different zombie narratives that we sort of popularize and talk about, every generation seems to put its own sort of stamp or its own unique sort of historical imprint onto the figure of the monster. That's kind of what I really appreciate about zombie narratives of the 21st century. The videos and the stories that I grew up with in the 80s and the 90s, they were of a certain variety of zombies, right? These sort of shambling corpses that would pursue you to all ends of the earth, but they were, you know, they would walk across the landscape, and they would terrorize, you know, any corner that they could get into. Today's zombies are runners. They're sprinters. They are very agile. And I think in a lot of ways, they reflect the sort of accelerated pace of modern living in this technologized world. So you really see a sense of evolution in this particular monster, which is always kind of exciting because they always bring that new and unexpected element to their stories.
Yeah, and one of the things that I know you hone in on in your class is this idea that zombies are a metaphor for things we're experiencing in society. Can you talk a bit more about where you've seen that throughout the years?
In the last couple of years alone, right, we've come out of this global pandemic and everybody has been talking about, you know, sheltering in place, finding safe spaces, protecting their bubbles, and so on and so forth. And, you know, modern zombie narratives are sort of built on this trope of infection that seems to spread like wildfire, not just through the zombie bites, but also through fear and panic, and sort of this desperate search for survival and safe spaces. So in a lot of ways, you know, watching zombie shows like The Walking Dead, for instance, while, you know, sheltering in place during the global pandemic has sort of given me, just as a viewer, this really sort of heightened sense an appreciation for the way that the human survivors in these shows really sort of go all out to try to protect themselves from this global pandemic, this thing that has sort of settled on society.
We're talking with Drago Mamsilovic right now, senior lecturer in comparative literature at UW-Milwaukee, talking about zombies and why they've been around in pop culture for so long and what they can tell us. And Drago, how far in the past does the zombie in popular imagination go? How far does the history stretch?
Well, it depends on the iteration of the zombie that you're talking about. I think that most people have a certain idea of what a zombie is. It's usually this reanimated corpse that's arisen from the dead. And if we're talking about the zombie in those terms, then probably George Romero's 1968 film, Night of the Living Dead, would have been one of the archetypal narratives that starts that tradition. But what's also interesting about that film is that none of the characters in that film actually utter the word zombie. They sort of refer to them as things, and you know, the radio broadcasters that are reporting on this epidemic refer to the behavior as sort of criminal and cannibalist. I think that's because there's a very particular conception of the zombie that comes out of Caribbean folklore, particularly during the colonial and post-colonial eras. And that particular vision of the quote-unquote monster is much different than the reanimated corpse that we sort of have come to know and have adopted in our cultural lexicon.
And we actually have a clip on hand from George Romero's 1968 Night of the Living Dead. This is a clip from when brother and sister Johnny and Barbara visit a cemetery and find out that not everyone there is truly dead.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
Stop it! You're acting like a child.
Look, they're coming for you. Look, there comes one of them now.
He'll hear you.
Here he comes now. I'm getting out of here.
Johnny! Oh, no! No! Johnny! Help me!
Now, Drago, I saw Night of the Living Dead for the first time just a few months ago, and wow, that's the textbook for how to make a movie with about $5 in your pocket. But beyond that, I thought it was really impressive. Can you talk a bit more about what the themes you're seeing in there are?
Well, that film, I believe, was released, I think, maybe 6 months after the assassination of Dr. King in 1968. So there is sort of this ambiance of racial tension and unrest that sort of forms the backdrop against which this film is set. And you can see traces of you know, race relations that come forward in the way that the characters interact with each other. The main protagonist is a man by the name of Ben, who's played by Dwayne Jones, the great Dwayne Jones, an African-American actor. And he is, I'm sorry about the spoiler, but I have to spoil the end of the film, unfortunately. He is the lone survivor in his group. But he sort of endures countless, you know, attacks as well as microaggressions from other survivors in the house where he's holed up. And the way in which Ben loses his life at the end of the movie is sort of eerily reminiscent of the violence of that era in the sort of larger struggle for civil rights. So there are ways of reading contemporary debates about race in a film from 1968. There's also this really interesting backdrop about American exceptionalism during the Cold War and sort of countering American might, military might, and scientific advancement against the growing competition that the United States saw from the communist East, in particular the Soviet Union. So all of those elements, I think, sort of combine and percolate in that movie, and they create this sense of a very uneasy and unstable atmosphere that the zombie then sort of disrupts and explodes altogether.
Yeah, and it's basic level, the zombie movie is about keeping something out. Do we see other movies or shows later on pick up on those themes of race and xenophobia?
Absolutely. And especially as the zombie sort of migrates to television shows like The Walking Dead, where there's much more of a sustained attention on not just the outbreak of zombies, but also how you sort of survive in that world where the zombie is now a given, and the kinds of human community that emerge in the face of that. A show like The Walking Dead, for instance, which premiered in 2010. It was based on a series of comic books that came out in 2003, started coming out in 2003. That show really sort of plays with the idea of survival in the zombie post-apocalypse, but the forms of community that become, you know, part of the show really sort of take over, in a manner of speaking, in such a way that, you know, the primary focus is not necessarily on the monsters themselves, but on the potential monsters that human survivors become or have to become in the quest for survival. So it's really sort of cutthroat in a lot of ways, because suddenly xenophobia becomes a survival skill, right? It's an ugly reality that many of these survivors have to face, but you know, the question of who to admit into your community, who will be a benefit or an asset to your community, and who is potentially a threat. Those are some of the questions that the survivors continually wrestle with, especially in television shows like The Walking Dead.
Drago Mamasilovic is with us, senior lecturer in comparative literature at UW-Milwaukee, also a self-proclaimed lifelong fan of zombies. He's talking with us about the meaning of zombies in pop culture, and we want to hear from you too at 800-642-1234. Did zombies scare you as a kid? What do you think of them now? Do you have any favorite zombie movies or TV shows to share with us, or maybe video or board games? What do you think about the zombie genre? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Thriller by Michael Jackson playing us in right now, because we are talking about zombies with UW-Milwaukee lecturer Drago Mamasilovic. Zombies in popular culture and what they can tell us about society, what we're scared of and why. And we want to hear from you too at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite zombie TV show, movie? What do you like about it? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We also heard from Jacqueline on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Peter on Facebook said, I was never too impressed with the zombie up until World War Z. The zombie was mostly portrayed as a slow, lumbering creature of minimal intelligence. Seemed that it would be pretty easy to get away from. Now, Drago, you, I know, talk about World War Z, the book, and the subsequent movie in your class, and this idea that the zombie gets more physically intimidating. What do you think about that?
I think it's absolutely true, and I would agree with that comment. My students and I just wrapped up a series of discussions about that novel, and they were really fascinated by certain aspects of it that I was fascinated by when I first read it. We didn't watch the movie, unfortunately, but maybe another day. And I think that there's something really interesting about the military metaphor that's often used in the novel to address the question of the zombie war and how to tackle sort of this outbreak of instability and sort of foreign menace in that particular context. Because one of the biggest, I guess, strengths of the zombie is that it can aggregate into these large hordes that are absolutely unstoppable. And one of the I guess, key rescue features, one of the key strategies that the novel sort of unveils for us is this idea of declaring total war on the zombie in the same way that the zombie has declared total war on humanity. And by total war, I mean this idea that the zombie doesn't stop until it pursues the living and attacks and kills the living, right? There's no downtime that the zombie sort of devotes to other things. It's always 100% of the time devoted to that cause. So the people in the novel have to defeat the zombie on similar terms. So yeah, there's something very intense and extreme and disciplined about the way that the zombie menace is portrayed in that context.
And another piece of media where the zombie is very fast and very intimidating is the South Korean film Train to Busan from 2016, which I've seen, and it's pretty unsettling. It's pretty cool, but it is frightening. How do we see countries outside of the U.S. taking up the zombie genre and doing something new with it?
I think a lot of different countries have been paying attention to what Romero specifically was doing in the 1960s and really throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Night of the Living Dead for Romero was the beginning of a very successful film franchise, which led to other projects, including novelizations of his work. And those stories have international audiences, right? They sort of permeated the globe. And what we're seeing in today's generation of filmmakers and TV creators is this real sort of appreciation for what George Romero started, but what these people are sort of doing and translating into the context of their own cultures, their own histories, their own languages. Train to Busan is a really interesting example because it all takes place on this, you know, high-speed train, which, you know, in a lot of ways seems like a fantasy that Americans have, but, you know, it's not part of our reality yet, the idea of a high-speed train. And the zombies themselves, they attack simply for the sake of spreading and replicating this thing that has infected them, this microbe, whatever it is. And so, you know, it calls to mind a very different conception of the zombie, right? Not something that feeds on human flesh in order to survive, but something that spreads because that is the primary goal. That is the modus operandi, to spread. And that's a slightly different take on the zombie, but it also explains the accelerated pace, the greater sense of peril in that kind of universe, and the greater sense of loss. I mean, the damage that the zombie does is much more widespread than we've seen in other narratives.
Talking with Drago Mamsilovic from UW Milwaukee about zombies and popular culture. Let's go to the phones now. We've got Dan in Prairie du Sac. Hi, Dan.
Hey, I don't know if this is really a zombie movie. I just remember it watching it as a kid, and it might have had Paul Newman. It was Omega Man.
Omega Man. Drago, are you familiar with that one?
I am not, but I am curious.
And Dan, what do you remember about that one? What do you like about it?
Oh, just like there was some kind of virus that, and there were these creatures with like green eyes or something. They were humans. They were kind of like zombies, and then they hunted the people who didn't have this virus. And I thought it had Paul Newman in it. Anyway, I just thought I'd share that.
Gotcha, Dan. Thanks for the call. We will keep that on our radar. And Drago, even if a movie doesn't necessarily have a zombie per se, there's a lot of zombie adjacent villains in horror, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the zombie is kind of an elastic concept, an elastic category. We have, you know, sort of these traditional zombies that have evolved into sort of these high-speed iterations, like the ones that we see in Train to Busan. And the pace and acceleration really does reflect the kind of technologized and industrialized culture of modern South Korea. But what's also interesting is that a show like HBO's The Last of Us, which is an adaptation of a video game, an interactive video game, I believe, it doesn't feature zombies per se, but it resuscitates many of the same themes. And it also plays with this idea of, you know, a technology network that the zombie sort of becomes part of. One of the great things about The Last of Us in particular is that when the survivors are walking through the decimated landscape and they encounter a zombie somewhere or some kind of creature that's been infected, they also run the risk of awakening the entire network of creatures that they are linked to biologically and through this strange fungus that has sort of, you know, taken over their physical sensoria. And so as a result, you know, any sort of local stimulation or encounter can threaten to awaken the entire monster, as it were. And that sort of raises the stakes once again, as far as what the zombie can do and the kind of damage we can sort of envision it causing.
And Drago, we just have about a minute or so left, but I wanted to get your thoughts on Halloween and spooky season more broadly than just zombies, because Halloween is really popular right now. People are counting down the days in June for Halloween, and it's not just for kids anymore. What do you think's going on?
I think adults love zombies. Adults love candy. Adults love the conviviality of hanging out together, enjoying, you know, shared interests, especially after the last 2 or 3 years. And there's a great sense of jubilation, I think, that people can sort of participate in, right? You know, fear can bring us together. Disgust over the zombie body can bring people together. And it can also be a great source of humor. So that's an important part of the history of zombie cinema. There's great humor in a lot of these films. And I think that, you know, a culture that celebrates those elements, I think there's an organic connection between those things.
And as we wrap up, what is the next zombie-related piece of media that you're teaching in your class?
I believe that's a good question, actually. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about Fall of the House of Usher by Edgar Allan Poe, and a short story by Stephen King called You Know They Got a Hell of a Band, which features Buddy Holly and Janis Joplin as zombies.
Cool stuff. Well, Drago, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
Drago Momcilovic is a senior lecturer in the Comparative Literature Program at UW-Milwaukee. He joined us for a Halloween-themed conversation looking at what zombies can tell us about our society, our own fears, and why they have such a long history in pop culture. And a reminder that you can listen back to this conversation and all of the conversations we've had here on Central Time by browsing the Ideas Network archives at WPR.org. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. It's been almost 3 weeks since Kevin McCarthy was ousted as Speaker of the House, and Republicans in the chamber have been unable to elect a new leader despite multiple attempts. First, it was House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana, and last week it was Jim Jordan of Ohio who failed to garner enough support to take the gavel. Tonight, House Republicans are meeting for a closed-door candidate forum to determine who will be the next to run for the speakership, with 9 representatives throwing their name in the ring. We're looking back at what's held up the race for speaker and where the House could go from here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the failure so far to elect a new speaker? How do you think Republicans should proceed from here? What questions do you have about how all this works or what the House can or can't do without a speaker in place? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. David Cannon is Professor Emeritus in the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. He taught courses on Congress, American government, and politics. He's the author of multiple books, including The Dysfunctional Congress, The Individual Roots of an Institutional Dilemma. David, it's good to have you back on Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, 2 weeks, 2 candidates, 2 dropouts. Can you walk us through why first Steve Scalise and then Jim Jordan were not able to get the support that they needed?
Well, basically, they have to be elected with a majority of the House. And so you can only lose 5 Republican votes and still be elected Speaker. And so there's a very thin margin. If you have extremists on one side of the party or even the other, that's enough to prevent them from getting majority. That's exactly what happened with both Scalise and Jordan. With Scalise, he saw the handwriting on the wall and didn't even proceed to a vote. Jordan pushed it to the floor and tried 3 different times to have a vote of the entire chamber, and his support went down on each round from 200 votes on the first round to 199 to 194. And then the most significant move is that they went to a closed session of the party caucus on Friday after that third vote and had a secret ballot. So not, you know, accountable, not knowing at all, you know, who was voting which way. And he only managed to get 86 votes when it was a secret ballot. And differing counts had 112 or 122 that voted against him. But in any event, not even a majority of the caucus when there was a secret vote. And once that happened, he withdrew as well, realizing that there was no path forward for him to become speaker.
Now, Steve Scalise got some of the same opposition that Kevin McCarthy got from the farther right side of the party, the Freedom Caucus, and some others. Where was the opposition from Jim Jordan coming from?
It was actually kind of all over the map. There was a really nice analysis of this in the Washington Post a couple of days ago, and they broke it down to the 25 people who voted against Jim Jordan, and they really did come from different parts of the party. So some of them came from, I think there were nine of them that came from districts that voted for Biden. And so those are the more, you know, moderate-leaning districts. There were some even from the Freedom Caucus. There were some from the what's called the Governing Caucus, people that are more interested in, say, not shutting down the government. And so it was a real mix. It wasn't as clear as the opposition to first Kevin McCarthy and then Scalise. It really was all over the map. And a few of them even who had supported Jordan on the first or second ballot voted against him on the third ballot because of the bullying tactics that Jordan was trying to use to coerce members of his own party to vote for him, including having several members come to the floor and say that they, and even their family members, their wives, received death threats from people. And Representative Bacon said that his wife was sleeping with a loaded pistol, you know, under her pillow because she was so frightened by some of the death threats that they were getting. And so there were some people who voted against him, not for ideological reasons, not for policy reasons, but for tactical reasons of just really being opposed to the methods that he was trying to use, these strong arm tactics, intimidation tactics to try to win the votes.
We're talking with David Cannon, Professor Emeritus at UW-Madison, about the race for House Speaker, where things stand and what's next. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones right now. We have Chuck in Waukesha County. Hi, Chuck.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Question I have is, how can approximately 8 Congress members, representatives of the so-called Freedom Caucus, yield such clout that none of the moderates or none of the even, you know, conservative or and more liberal Republicans can't override that? I just don't understand it. They all kowtow in line like they're afraid of something. To me, that's democracy that is going down the drain real quick. So that's my question. I'll take any response off the air. Thank you.
Chuck, thanks for the call.
I think Chuck's exactly David, right. They are afraid of something. They're afraid of the response they will get from the right wing of the party and from Trump supporters. Because, you know, we haven't mentioned, you know, Trump's influence on this yet, but he was a strong supporter of Jim Jordan. And so I think this loss, him pulling out of the race, was a real blow to Trump's leadership. And the fact that you see that huge difference in support when they went to the secret ballot, where his support falls from 194 to 86, you know, clearly shows exactly what Chuck just said, that, you know, those 108 people that, you know, changed their votes basically were afraid of putting their names out in public. But when that vote could be secret, they were, you know, indicating that there was no way they would support Jim Jordan. And so I think that people who would normally be more mainstream Republicans right now are afraid to take that position publicly because they're afraid of getting primary. They're afraid of having someone from the right run against them in the primary. So that's exactly what's happening. The second part of this question was also really important. Something I wanted to bring up was the potential role of the moderates here. And there is still a possibility that if what happens, you know, tonight and tomorrow, so tonight they'll have the votes where they'll winnow down those nine candidates down to their nominee, and this will happen in a sequential voting process until someone emerges with the majority, and on each round, the person with the fewest votes will be dropped off the ballot. So eventually, if it's split evenly, it'll be a head-to-head race, and it could take as many as, you know, seven rounds to get there. But eventually, they'll have majority support for a nominee. That'll then go to the chamber for a vote tomorrow. And so if that fails, and if the, say Tom Emmer, who's the party whip, number three in the House leadership, is seen as being probably the favored candidate right now to garner majority support within the party, is probably the most likely person right now to get the nomination. But Trump does not trust him, and he's because he was one of the two of the nine who actually did not vote against certifying Joe Biden's election on January 6th. The other seven all voted against certifying Biden's election, at least in one of the states. And so automatically he becomes, you know, a suspicious you know, candidate for Donald Trump. And so Trump has had his surrogates arguing on Fox News and elsewhere that Emmer can't be trusted. He should vote against Emmer. Well, if Emmer emerges as the nominee, you can imagine him not getting 218 votes, or 217 votes, actually, because there are two vacancies right now, 217 votes to become speaker. And then we'd have, you know, another deadlock. And then what happens? Well, at that point, you potentially have a role for the moderates, because what you could have is as few as five or six of the Republicans, of the more moderate Republicans, could coalesce with the Democrats and elect someone like Tom Emmer. And this is something that Hakeem Jeffries and Jim McGovern, the ranking member of the Rules Committee, have been working behind the scenes with some Republicans to, you know, try to make that happen. And so there, you know, the moderates could play a decisive role if they decided to vote, you know, for basically the, you know, majority wishes rather than the extreme faction of their party. And it'd be a very tough vote for any Republican to do that, but it's possible we'll end up there if nothing comes out of the meeting tonight and then the round of voting starting again tomorrow.
And Representative Tom Emmer is one of the perceived frontrunners right now, in part because he's earned the endorsement of former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Here's a listen to McCarthy talking about that.
This is not a moment in time to play around with learning on the job. We need someone who understands how to do this job. I believe Tom Emmer, our whip, he's been in the room with all of our successes, from our bills to secure the border, from parents' bill of rights, from cutting $2 trillion, getting work requirements. He knows how to do the job across the street at the same time, helping us win the majority. He sets himself head and shoulders above all those others who want to run. We need to get him elected this week and move on.
I think traditionally, you know, in the Schoolhouse Rock version of how you win House Speaker, deal making and good relationships would have been, you know, enough to get it done. Is it still?
Well, no, clearly it's not. I mean, the fact that someone like Jim Jordan was even the second person they would go to, Jim Jordan is sort of the antithesis of that, that he has, you know, for his whole career been not about coalition building and, you know, trying to make winning coalitions, especially across the party aisle, but instead has been very much more about a very ideological message and obstruction in more cases than not. So no, I think you're exactly right that the rules of the game seem to have changed. On the other hand, again, that secret vote that they had shows you do have a fairly substantial majority of the Republican caucus still that doesn't want to go that route. And that's what makes me think that, you know, if the majority of Republicans can't get behind Tom Emmer, maybe they'll decide, well, let's elect Emmer, but do it with the Democrats instead. And I think that they could cut a deal that, you know, Hakeem Jeffries has publicly said what they would want is the ability to basically suspend the Hastert rule, which is not really a rule, but a norm that dates back to the speakership of Dennis Hastert, which said that a bill will not come to the floor unless it has majority support within the majority party, so within the Republican Party. And so something that has, you know, support of maybe, you know, 250, 280 people in the House, a large, you know, majority, wouldn't come to the floor if most of that support was in the Democratic Party and only a handful of Republicans supporting it. Now, that's again, that's something that the Democrats would like to see, that norm suspended, so they can bring things to the floor, with support of the Democratic Party and moderate Republicans. And that would be a big ask. I don't think Republicans would probably go along with that as a condition for electing Tom Emmer. But I think that they probably could agree to a smaller subset of demands, something like getting rid of the motion to vacate by one person, which is what Matt Gaetz did to bring down Kevin McCarthy. That was, a concession that McCarthy made to get elected in the first place on the 15th ballot. And that's something that he's regretting, I think, that he did that. So getting rid of that, I think, would be condition one. The aid package to Ukraine and Israel would be another thing that should have the ability to come up for a majority vote, because that clearly has majority support in the House, maybe not majority support in the Republican Party. So they would demand that. And then promises of no government shutdowns, increasing the debt ceiling, a few other things like that. I think if they kept the wish list fairly short, you could see the Democrats getting behind Tom Emmer if he fails to get majority support from just Republicans. And they'd have to be able to cut those deals to make that happen.
We're talking to UW-Madison political science professor emeritus David Cannon about the efforts to elect a new House Speaker and what's next for Republicans. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you think Republicans can reach that agreement on a new House Speaker? Do you wish Democrats would get involved and cut one of those deals? What concerns you most about the House going without a Speaker for an extended period of time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with David Cannon, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at UW-Madison. We're talking about the latest efforts to elect a new House Speaker after multiple failed attempts. Taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Let us know your questions and comments about this. 800-642-1234. David, I wanted to ask you, how have Wisconsin's Republican delegation in the House been voting on this?
So they voted for Jordan. I think all the Republicans voted for Jordan on all three ballots, I believe. And then, the Scalise didn't come up for a vote. And then on the secret vote, of course, we don't know because those were not publicly indicated. And I don't believe any of them have said publicly how they voted on that secret vote.
So we have nine candidates with their hat in the ring as of right now to become the next speaker. Representative Mike Flood of Nebraska is circulating a so-called unity pledge. Can you tell us what this is all about?
Yeah, the unity pledge is basically the idea that you will support whoever the nominee ends up being, and you'll pledge that ahead of time before these votes even happen. And so far, there has been quite a bit of resistance to that, especially from the Freedom Caucus members, who I think some who maybe do have suspicions about Tom Emmer's support for Donald Trump, for example, wouldn't want to commit to voting for Tom Emmer if he ends up being the nominee. So I don't think that that is going to gain traction. At least I doubt that it's going to be a binding kind of rule that they impose on the all Republican members. I would be surprised if they did that.
One other traction check, the idea of giving temporary speaker Patrick McHenry more powers, the ability to pass legislation on the floor. Any momentum there?
Yeah, that's still kind of on the back burner. So that one they actually did bring up. That came up before this secret vote was taken on Friday that gave the signal to Jim Jordan that he was finished. And Jordan had at least some of his supporters said that he was on board with that idea initially as a way to try to buy him more time to garner the support he needed to become speaker. And there was talk of even giving these additional powers to Patrick McHenry through January. And then Jordan later said, no, he wasn't on board with that. And that then was also shot down before the secret vote was taken on Friday. So that one still could be a fallback. Let's say things crash and burn tomorrow. No one of the nine ends up getting 217 votes and we still don't have a speaker. That could be a fallback instead of this bipartisan possibility of working with the Democrats. And one last point on that possibility, just so your listeners know that this is not some crazy thing that's never been done. It's true, it's never been done in the U.S. House of Representatives, but it's happened in state legislatures 22 times since 1994, including this year in Ohio and Pennsylvania in their House of Representatives, and in Alaska in both their House and Senate. They elected their leadership, the Speaker, with a bipartisan vote. And in some cases, historically, they even elected the Speaker or Majority Leader of the Senate from the minority party. It even happened in a few cases. Now, that's even more unusual. So that'd be like Hakeem Jeffries becoming Speaker. That clearly is not going to happen here in this instance. I think there is the precedent for that, at least at the state level. And so I think that still is another backup plan. But the expanding the powers of the acting Speaker, Patrick Henry, is definitely another possibility if things, you know, don't pan out tomorrow.
In terms of congressional business, you mentioned aid for Ukraine, an aid package related to the Israel-Hamas war. Also, a government spending stopgap bill is going to run out on November 17th. What are the stakes? What's going to happen if we get to that point without something else in place?
Right. No, absolutely. The government shutdown again on November 17th is another real deadline that is approaching. The Senate continues to work on its appropriations bills and, you know, trying to move the process along. But without the House, you know, being able to do anything, if we don't have a resolution by mid-November, we'll be back to shutting down the government. And so I can't imagine this will drag on till then. I mean, as dysfunctional as things have been in the House, I can't imagine we wouldn't have a Speaker, you know, by the middle of November. So that is another point of urgency, though, to move things along, is that we really do need to have the House able to operate, hopefully well before then, because the situation clearly in Ukraine and the Mideast is getting, you know, more dire by the day.
And whether this wraps up in a few days, a week, a few months, do you expect to see this becoming a campaign issue or affecting, you know, the political fortunes of Republicans in their next elections?
Well, yes, clearly this is something that right now Republicans in those swing districts are very worried about, especially a lot of those New York Republicans who were elected in Biden districts. They've been some of the more outspoken on the need to get this done and not to have this hang over the House of Representatives any longer. So, yes, I think this is the political fallout from this. You know, it's not going to be huge because, you know, most Republicans are in pretty safe districts. But those Republicans that are in swing districts, especially, again, I think there are about 17 who are elected from districts that Joe Biden carried, you know, they are worried about this. And Democrats are using this right now to their political advantage and fundraising appeals. They're mentioning the dysfunction of the House. So this is something I think is clearly in the interest of the Republican Party to try to wrap this up and to get a Speaker elected.
And in that next that under that next speakership, you mentioned the idea of getting rid of the motion to vacate that ousted Kevin McCarthy. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate has backed that idea of getting rid of it. Do you think we might move in that direction in the future?
Yes. So maybe not getting rid of it entirely, but at least increasing the number needed to bring that motion up for a vote. Because, again, what the Freedom Caucus bargained for with Kevin McCarthy when he was first elected was to have a single member be able to do that. I think if you would raise that to even, I don't know, 10%, maybe 25% of the caucus, that would be enough of a hurdle that this would be much more difficult. So in this case, you know, Kevin McCarthy would still be Speaker. If they had that 10% threshold, he would still be Speaker. And so that, I think, is something that should be restored for sure, because we don't need this kind of chaos. And if we're going to continue to be in these political situations with tight margins, what it looks like we're going to be for probably the next several election cycles, that having that kind of power in the hands of such a few extremists really does not serve the interests of either party.
Well, David, thanks for joining us and getting us up to speed.
Good to be with you. Thanks a lot.
David Cannon is Professor Emeritus at the UW-Madison Department of Political Science. He was with us today to look at the ongoing attempts by House Republicans to elect a new speaker and where the race could go from here. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, navigating the Medicare system can be tough. A Wisconsin health insurance expert joins the show to offer some tips and answer your questions. Plus, Wisconsin is a few years into legal hemp growing. We'll learn about some of the many products being made from hemp around the state. That's tomorrow morning after 7. To celebrate its 25th anniversary, the National Toy Hall of Fame is giving one of the Forgotten Five a shot at immortality. The Forgotten Five are the five toys that have been nominated for the Hall of Fame the most times without getting in. And in a first, we the public can vote. The candidates are Transformers action figures, My Little Pony horses, the Pogo Stick, Pez dispensers, and the Fisher-Price Corn Popper. That's the toy with the wheels and the little colored balls that pop up and down. Now, my grandpa was a woodworker, and he made me a similar toy with wooden wheels. And instead of filling the wheels with ping pong balls, he used solid wooden balls. Now, that was very loud. I loved it, but I think he might have been playing a joke on my parents. Voting on that contest closes tomorrow night. You can make your pick on the National Toy Hall of Fame's website. Stay tuned. This is Central Time.